scroll down here under recent sermons, click on February 25, and then you can click and load the notes and follow along with us online. So we're going to resume this, and I got some ideas about kind of where I want to go with some things moving forward as we continue to lay out this information. So let's just get right into it. Lesson 226, the AV 610-11, Early Sales, Ecclesiastical and Private Sales. In Lesson 224, we began looking at the early sales of the AV by considering the following aspects of the early 17th century Bible market. We looked at the printing capacity of the king's printer. We looked at Bible and Bible production before the AV. So that would have been with the Geneva and Bishop's Bibles. And then we looked at financing and printing rights. We did that in Lesson 224. This discussion continued in Lesson 225 as we studied the following additional points, variety of formats and sizes, and then market structure, monopoly, and book sales. So we looked at how the king's printer paid somewhere between $1.5 million and $2 million in modern-day American money equivalents to secure the rights to print the text, and sort of what all that meant. We looked at that in Lesson 225. In the current lesson, we want to conclude our consideration of this topic by looking at one final point, and that is ecclesiastical and private sales. Okay? So, all that was just quick review. We've obviously spent a lot of time talking about different aspects of this. I want to move into new information, though. So we're still looking at understanding the early 17th century Bible market. We've just been looking at these different points and facets of it. So for this lesson, we will be using Professor Kenneth Fincham's 2020 article for the Journal of Ecclesiastical History titled The King James Bible, Crown, Church, and People to frame the discussion. So this is another one of those very important essays that has been written in the last 15 to 20 years that covers aspects of this topic that have not necessarily been dealt with or discussed with any level of depth before that point. So in Lesson 186, we discussed the question of whether the Crown ever officially, quote, authorized the AV. In his essay, Fincham brings up this topic within the context of early sales of the AV. Now, this is an interesting point, and I've never seen anybody else make this point as I've looked at information about this. He says, quote, This widespread belief that the new translation was authorized matters to us since it provided the legality for bishops to require its purchase and replace a serviceable older translation, and it explains why no church warden challenged their right to do so. It is true that the authorized version as a phrase only dates from the 1820s, but its meaning was familiar to many Jacobins. So let's just try to understand what he's getting at, okay? So the whole point of doing the King James Bible in the first place was to provide a Bible for church use. That was one of the major objectives of it, right? For public use in the church. If you read the title page, if you remember, it says to be read in the church. It was to be read out loud, right? So now we're coming down to it, and the Bible gets printed. And the question of whether or not it was ever officially authorized is important when it comes to requiring Anglican churches to replace their current Bible with the new Bible. Okay? So if they still have, for example, a perfectly serviceable bishop's Bible and they don't really need a new one, what warrant would there be for them to be required to buy the new Bible is what Fincham is getting at here in this point. Okay? Put another way, if the Crown was not mandating that parish churches replace older editions, such as the bishop's Bible for pulpit use, what motivation was there for local bishops to spend money on the new Bible? This, in turn, would have impact on the early sales of the AV. Because remember, the first year, the only thing that was published were the large folio editions, and those were the ones that were printed primarily for church use, not necessarily for private ownership, okay? So if there's no official authorization or official word that they have to replace these bishops' Bibles, what motivation does somebody have to buy one to replace a Bible that is currently not worn out or what have you, okay? Fincham explores these issues in greater detail and depth than we have seen in any other source. So his information here on this topic is the best information that I've seen out there to kind of explain what's going on here, okay? Part two of Fincham's essay opens with the following question. In the absence of a royal injunction for parishes to buy the new translation, how rapidly did folio versions of the King James Bible reach parish lecterns and become part of regular worship? So that's the question, right? If they had a Bible and it was not worn out and it was still serviceable and it was a bishop's Bible, maybe even a Geneva Bible in some parishes, depending, okay, why would they need to buy another one is sort of the main question, okay? And again, just to state it again the way Fincham does, in the absence of a royal injunction for parishes to buy the new translation, how rapidly did folio versions of the King James Version reach parish lecterns and become part of the regular worship? According to Fincham, there are three relevant sources of historical data to answer this question. Number one, something which is called visitation articles, which we'll explain when we get there. Second, church court records. And third, church wardens' accounts. So he's saying there are three sources of historical information that could help us answer this question of how, in the absence of a mandate to buy one of these, how they sold in their early way, okay, in the earliest days of the King James. Diocesan and parochial evidence indicates that the acquisition of folio or church Bibles was quite protracted and stretched in some dioceses well into the 1630s. There are three principal sources for this investigation: visitation articles, church court records, and wardens' accounts, and they need to be read together and against each other. So in other words, he's saying, if you want an accurate picture, you have to look at all three of these different categories. You have to read them against each other and compare them to really get a good picture handle on what was going on as far as early sales. Now, this is what I'm calling ecclesiastical sales. And what I mean by ecclesiastical sales is sales to parish churches for use in the parish church service, as opposed to private sales, which would be Joe Schmo in off the street going to a bookshop and buying a Bible for who? Himself or his family or something like that, okay? So, of these three sources, only visitation articles have been consulted by previous studies according to Fincham. Quote, these articles of inquiry issued by bishops and other ecclesiastical ordinaries suggest that there was little concern to see parishes purchase the new Bible. Merely 35% mentioned it in 1612 to 1624, rising to 50% for 1625 to 1641. Such bald figures are somewhat misleading, since these articles were often formulaic and sometimes adopted wholesale from either visitations, and so do not necessarily disclose the priorities of the visitor. So in other words, this would be somebody visiting a church and writing a report about what they saw during their visits. Okay? Not something we necessarily do with any regularity in our day, but something that happened quite frequently back then, which might be read out or circulated in a charge at meetings during the visitation. Articles of inquiry needed supplementing by church wardens' presentments recorded in consistory court and visitation books, and by surveys of church furnishings which took place in some jurisdictions. These court records, in turn, are complemented by evidence of the purchasing and selling of books in church wardens' accounts, even though these survive for only about 8% of English parishes. So in other words, the way I take a church warden's account is similar to like our financial report. Right? The church has an annual meeting. We have our State of the Assembly address. As part of that meeting, we present a financial accounting of everything that happened in the last year, where money was spent, those kinds of things, right? So that's the way I take a church warden's report, is similar to that sort of a financial report that we would be familiar with. The triangulation of these three factors paints the following picture of early ecclesiastical sales for the AV. So when you take then the visitation articles, the church court records, and the warden's accounts, you get the following picture of early sales according to what Fincham's saying. Some parishes bought the new translation at once. So in other words, it came off the press and they what? They bought it right away. All right. without prompting from higher authority. So they just wanted to have it, and so they bought it. A good example, albeit a highly unusual parish, is the University Church of St. Mary the Great in Cambridge, which bought its copy very shortly after publication, a thoroughly appropriate acquisition given the university's immense contribution to the translation project. So there are members of the faculty that are involved in that, and so it makes sense that they would go buy one. Okay. However, given the costs involved, most waited to be prodded. So there's the caveat, right? So more parish churches waited until they were explicitly told to do what? Buy it. Okay? So that sort of makes sense as well. However, given the costs involved, most waited to be prodded. The bishops themselves, we're at the bottom of page 2. The bishops themselves moved at very different speeds. Bishop John King of London, not a translator but an intimate of Archbishop Abbott, was the first to require purchase by the parishes at his primary visitation of September 1612. So now here we have a bishop that is requiring people in his diocese to do what? To buy it as early as 1612. Large numbers of parishes duly comply. Bishop Smith of Gloucester, a translator and author of the preface, so that would be Miles Smith, did likewise at his primary visitation in 1613. Some 260 Gloucestershire parishes, about 95% of the total, were ordered to require a copy of the new translation within a month or two of Smith himself often presiding in court. Church, so in other words, there are they being required to buy it?
Yes.
Okay, and up to 95% of them comply and they buy it as far as the parish churches. Church wardens, top page 3, who would not comply were threatened with punitive fines of 20 shillings. Many returns were submitted certifying the purchase of the book, and almost all of the surviving church warden's accounts for the diocese record expenditure on a new Bible in the years 1613 to 1615. So again, these church warden's accounts are like financial statements or reports of the financial activity of a given parish church, right? And so they are recording in these accounts that they have spent money on the new what? On the new Bible, right? More common was the gradualist approach adopted in dioceses such as Bath and Wells, Exeter and Norwich, which where individual parishes were pushed to buy the new translation over more than a decade from 1612 to the mid-1620s, usually on the basis of church wardens' presentments, but also in the Archdeaconry of Norwich through annual inspections of church fabric and furnishings. So, a pulpit Bible would have been logged as in the possession of the church in one of these documents. That's the point. At Bath and Wells and elsewhere, parishes which pleaded that their Bible was in good condition, though not of the new translation, or else they were too poor to afford the new translation, were sometimes excused. The first unequivocal sign that Archbishop Abbott himself was instructing parishes to buy the new translation was not until 1616 in the Diocese of Coventry and Lichfield during a vacancy which was then followed up by the incoming Bishop John Overall. So here's the point, okay? You got a few different categories. Do some churches or parishes rush out immediately and buy it?
Yes.
Then you have sort of the moderate adopters that are ordered to buy it and do so once they're ordered. And then you have a third category where they're slowly over time buying them to replace these Bibles. Some of these parishes probably don't have a ton of money, and so they're maybe finding it more financially feasible to spend the money on something else, but eventually are they sort of ordered, okay, you guys got to get this. Okay, it's kind of a picture that's emerging here, okay? Elsewhere, the approach was slower still. In Peterborough Diocese, there is little sign of pressure on the parishes to acquire the new translation until 1619. a campaign which continued intermittently into the mid-1630s. This is not an isolated example. In the early 1630s, parishes in Durham diocese were acquiring the new Bible or else being presented for not possessing it, including, somewhat surprisingly, John Cousins' church of Branchpath, in about 1634. In 1632-33, a run of parishes in Leicester Archdeaconry still lacked the new translation, while in 1636, 14% of the parishes in Chichester Archdeaconry were ordered to buy a copy of the King James Bible. St. Stephen's Norwich, which had been repeatedly instructed to acquire a copy, finally succumbed in 1638-40. I'm assuming that's what that is, somewhere between 1638 and 40. All this suggests that the completion of a fitful document drive to install the King James Bible in parish churches is a neglected, albeit fairly minor, element of Laud's, this would be Archbishop Laud's, reformation of the English Church in the 1630s. The Laudian project, of course, extended across the British churches. The Scottish Church had continued to use the Geneva Bible throughout James VI's reign, and this may also have been the case in Ireland. In the Irish canon 1635 and the Scottish canon 1636, every parish church was required to possess a copy of the King James Bible. The latter had been printed at Edinburgh for the first time in 1633 to coincide with Charles I's coronation, with subsequent editions in 1634, 1637, 38, and the Scottish Prayer Book of 1637 incorporated in its translations for its readings of the Gospels, Epistles, and Psalms. However, there is little sign that the King James Bible was much used before the Covenanter Revolution of 1638-39 swept away Laudism and with the new canons and prayer book. So, is there slow, uneven adoption of the King James Bible into the parishes of England, Scotland, and Ireland?
Yeah.
It's happening at different speeds and at different rates, depending sort of on where the church was. It possibly also related to the affluence of the people in the parish and their ability to buy one. Okay? The slow purchase of church Bibles by parishes provides a fresh view of its a publishing history before 1640. Five folio versions of the King James Bible were printed between 1611 and 1617, and there was a gap of 12 years before the next followed by a further seven editions and reprints printed in London and Cambridge between 1629 and 1640. So remember, the folios are the largest Bibles. They're the monster big ones that were used in churches primarily, okay, for church use. Folio Bibles were purchased by a range of institutions, including the Chapel Royal, Cathedral, and Collegiate Churches, and by individuals such as the scholar and bibliophile Philip Dissey, but the single largest market was the English parishes. The relatively slow uptake in acquiring church Bibles in the 1610s implies that the 12-year cessation in printing them was not because the potential market was sated, and has been suggested, but rather because there was still stock available, as increasing numbers of parishes between 1617 and 1629 adopted the new translation. By the late 1620s, however, demand had overtaken supply. Here, the subsequent Laudian drive to ensure that all parishes owned a King James Bible is one explanation for the numerous folio editions from 1629 onwards, though London's attempt to undercut their rivals at Cambridge may be another significant driver. So, eventually Cambridge University Press gets the rights to print the Bible as well. But that doesn't come till later, okay? So, does anybody have any questions? I think what we're seeing here is an uneven adoption of the King James into the local parishes once it's published. And this does speak to the fact, because remember that Archbishop Bancroft died in 1610, This was published in 1611, and so there never was a mandate given from the Archbishop of Canterbury that all the churches needed to buy. And so the adoption of it is uneven. AJ?
Those that are purchasing the Bible, the majority of them, are they strictly the clergy and we'll say the learned group, those that are business people that actually have an education to read? Because my understanding is back then you're looking at people who would buy a Bible for the family if they were well off from farming, but they still couldn't read it.
So I would say that that's partly right and partly wrong. The early sales are the figures we're talking about so far are only of the largest, the folios, which typically were bought by cathedrals, parish churches, and ecclesiastical figures. We're going to get to in a minute the smaller editions that are going to be bought by people privately.
So the slow uptake was really on the clergy side.
Yeah. The slow uptake of the folios was related to stuff going on with the clergy, yes.
How many families had Bibles back then in the 1611 to the 1620s? Did a lot of them have Bibles in the house, or did they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We had,
but they were bishops or they were Genevans, right?
So they were, by the time we get to the early 17th century, it's been about 100 years since the English people were banned from having their own Bible. So Englishmen have had Bibles privately for at least 100 years. By the time roughly, give or take, okay? And a lot of people already had Bibles in their home, probably Geneva Bibles, maybe some bishops' Bibles, but more notably Geneva Bibles.
And what I'm figuring out in my head is that they would go to church, and if they had a King James Bible, it was hard for them to follow along.
That's an interesting point. I don't know to what extent people would bring their Bible to church in those days. I just don't know the answer to that. But even in our day, like most churches, people don't even bother to bring a Bible anymore. It's sad, but it's a reality, right?
I did that in the Catholic.
Well, you know,
they actually asked me, and they said, "Hey, where's that guy out there that has the Bible? Because he had to have a passage. They did not have a Bible in the church."
I mean, that's not all that shocking, really, Art.
Do we have any idea what the price was for the churches? Because they got that $1 million fee to the printer.
I'm trying to remember if that's covered in this. Do you remember if we covered that in this lesson?
No, I don't think so.
I know they're not inexpensive. I don't remember. I mean, especially those folio ones. So 2 weeks ago, Mike brought in his, we said it was an octavo, right? He brought in an octavo Geneva Bible from 1560, and it was personal size. It wasn't a big folio, okay? The next year in 1612, they're immediately going to start printing smaller sizes for individual purchase. Those are going to sell quite well, as we'll see as we go through the lesson, compared to the folios that were for the pulpit service.
So how long did that $1 million original printing allowance, was that forever, or was that...
It should have been like in perpetuity, but I think legality things happen and he loses control over some of that.
Yeah.
But I do think, Sylvia, go ahead. You're trying to tell me that I think we do talk about this, right?
I think the next paragraph.
Okay. So let's go to the next paragraph. Regarding church court records and church warden accounts, Fincham writes, quote, "Church court records and church warden's accounts throw some light on attitudes towards the King James Bible in the parishes. A few wealthy parishioners step forward to buy a copy for their parish, but more common was a reluctance by church wardens to purchase the new Bible. Some had to be cited repeatedly before they would comply." So they're fine.
Yeah.
Okay? Before they would comply. Others claimed that they had an adequate edition, even though it was not the King James Version, or else pleaded poverty. No doubt the price was a major deterrent. Church wardens' accounts allow for us, for the first time, to establish some firm data on typical prices for the two types of bound folio volume, one large and the other smaller and cheaper. They ranged from 56 shillings down to 37 shillings with slight regional variations, the average representing twice the cost of Jewell's works in 1609. So what I'm understanding there is by the standards of the day, these are not cheap. They're at least twice the cost of any other book that you could buy. Okay? So that seems to be consistent. The real cost was lower than this, since many parishes sold off their old Bible, perhaps to local clergy, for about 10 shillings. So what some of them do is they sell the old one secondhand, try to recoup some money from it, so that then they could, you know, sort of foray that money into getting the new one. Nevertheless, buying a church Bible could generate friction, since it would often require a special parish rate to be levied, which might lead to disputes over individual contributions and to presentments in the court records. For these reasons, it is no surprise that some church wardens sat on their hands and awaited direct orders to purchase the new translation. This opposition seems to be practical rather than ideological. This is the point. It's not that they think this is a bad translation and they don't want it. It's that they can't necessarily what? Afford it. Okay? Big difference there in motivation. Indeed, on the rare occasions that we learn which translation these laggard parishes had been using, it seems that it was a mix. In the Diocese of Peterborough, with a sizable Puritan presence, there was a preference for the Geneva Bible, but a number of other churches used the Henry Sheehan Great Bible or the Bishop's Bible. So there is evidence that some of these churches were using the Geneva Bible in their church service and not a Bishop's Bible. And according to that statement, there were some that were even still using the Great Bible from Henry VIII's reign from 1539-1540. Okay? The fear of hostility to the new translation was articulated in the preface to the King James Bible. Many men's mouths have been opened a good while and yet are not stopped with speeches about the translation so long in hand, or rather perusals of translations made before it, and ask what may be the reason, what the necessity of the employment, hath the church been deceived, say all this while. So that's a quote from Miles Smith's preface, where he acknowledged, are some people speaking ill of this project? We've talked about that, right? Calumniation, slander, right? They're saying we didn't need this. That was the opinion of some, not all. Perhaps this is why its author, Miles Smith, gave his flock in Gloucestershire no choice but to purchase the new translation. Yet Smith went on inadvertently to justify this reluctance to require the new Bible with the famous statement, to the aim of the translators was, quote, not to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better. In other words, if the Bishop's Bible was a good translation, why not retain it, at least until the volume was wore out and needed replacing? Thomas Fuller, writing in the 1650s, suggested that some of the brethren in other wards, Puritans, disliked the King James Bible, suspecting it would abate the repute of that of the Geneva, and reported that others regarded the loss of the marginal notes, complaining that, quote, that they could not see into the sense of the Scripture for lack of the spectacles of those Geneva annotations. Now we're going to talk about this next time. This is why, eventually, a publisher at Amsterdam is going to publish King James Bibles with Geneva footnotes. Because people were complaining that they didn't have a problem with the translation. In fact, many of them thought it was a better translation, but they missed the marginal notes. Okay? Now I look at that and I say, okay, you know, I've got a Scofield Bible that's full of marginal notes and I hardly pay attention to any of them anymore. Like, okay, they're there, but I don't read them. Now, when I was 20 years old and just getting started in Bible study, I read them all the time. But you grow and you eventually are like, you don't need that stuff anymore because you develop your own independence in how to study and think for yourself, right? But such is the situation that existed. One answer came in 1642 through 49 when enterprising Dutch publishers, and this is what I just referred to, printers published a King James Bible with Geneva notes, the fact that the chosen text was the New Translation acknowledged its broad acceptability. So, there's literally, in my opinion, very little evidence that people objected to the translation of the King James. The text, the biblical text. What a lot of people didn't like is that it didn't have all the explanatory notes that were in the Geneva. Okay? Alright, before we move on, any questions or comments?
It sounds to me that back then, each parish in there, they would take, do you think they took a vote on to switch over to the Bible like that? Do you think they took a vote? Like, let's go to the King James?
I mean, some...
Or let's stay with the Geneva, let's stay with the bishops.
Some might have early on, but eventually they're basically
ordered to
replace it.
Governmental thing.
Yeah. And look, people, we don't like to think about this because it sort of cuts against our thinking as Americans. Okay? It just does. But you gotta understand, was the Bible a very political book in early 17th century England? We're gonna talk about this next week and in the following week, that when the English Civil War came and the Puritans took over the government, they very much promoted the Geneva Bible because they viewed the King James Bible as done by the crown and therefore, you know, subversive. Okay? And then when the restoration of the monarchy occurred, what do you think that meant for the fortunes of the English Bible? It meant the King James, you know, came back into, you know, sort of style. I don't know, it's not the right word, but you know what I'm saying. It became a symbol of conformity now to the monarchy that you would adopt, that you would start using what? The King James. And so we don't think about stuff like this, especially as Americans, because it sort of cuts against our grain of how we understand things. But back then, this was a very big deal, politically, to be involved in this, okay? I'll show you next week, I've actually pulled one down. Cromwell had he called it the Soldier's Pocket Bible. He had it published for the Puritans during the English Civil War, and it was a series of readings, all taken from a Geneva Bible, that he published and distributed to his army, so they could read it, as, you know, their encouragement as soldiers or whatever, and it was the majority of it was taken from a Geneva Bible. So like, the Bible becomes sort of a political hot potato, in a lot of these conversations in ways that we don't realize today. Okay? Alright, anybody else got any comments or questions?
I don't know, that's probably gonna come on earlier. How long before, cause 1621, the pilgrims came over here. How long before did we have the King James Bible in the U.S.?
So that's a debated point. There are staunch anti-King James only people who will say that the only Bible to make it over on the Mayflower was the Geneva Bible. And they do that to kind of make some sort of, you know, tally mark in their column, we scored a point against the King James, right? That's really what they're doing. But I've seen reports and other evidence to suggest that there were possibly one or two King James Bibles on the Mayflower or in the very next wave that came over. Okay? And so if you think of the pilgrims coming in 1619, I think it was, right? 1619? Pretty sure that's right. Just going from memory there, but I'm pretty sure that's right. All the way to independence. We signed the Declaration of Independence in 1776, right? So that's like, what, 150 years, let's just say, to keep it easy. No Bibles are printed on American soil because of the King's Print Patent. 1620. Because the colonists don't view themselves as having printing rights and authority to do it because they're still subject to the British Crown. It is only after we declare independence and then move to secure our independence through military conflict with the British Crown that we start printing the King James Bible on American shores. But I would say that it's very early on that eventually the King James becomes the main Bible in America. Way before independence. Does that make sense? All right. Now, everything we've looked at so far has been about ecclesiastical sales. We haven't said anything right now in these notes yet about individual or private sales. So let's look at the next point. Thus far, Fincham has only been considering the sales data for large folio pulpit editions for ecclesiastical use. When one considers the market for smaller personal-sized Bibles, the picture changes dramatically. Quote, Fuller's observations about the Geneva Notes are less pertinent to church Bibles than to personal Bibles, usually in quarto, which was the most popular format of the Geneva Bible. They must be counterbalanced by the extraordinary number of editions of the King James Bible in smaller and cheaper sizes other than folio, chiefly quartos, octavos, and duodecimos, in different packages. The whole Bible, the New Testament, and the third part of the Bible are often bound with the prayer book for scholarly, devotional, and household use. This demand started very early on. While the Geneva Bible was still being printed, between 1612 and 1615, for example, there were 10 editions in quarto and 7 in octavo. While we do not know the print runs, which may have been initially small to test the market, the sheer number of editions indicates strong demand to own a copy, not necessarily to replace the Geneva or the Bishop's Bible, which presumably many had, but to add to them. So the market evidence suggests that within the first 6 years, are there many editions of smaller sizes being published? Okay? So this, what you surmise from that then is, if there was not a robust private market, are the publishers going to be willing to make these available and spend the money on them? Okay? There were about 140 editions of the King James Bible in 1611 to 1640. Okay? As many as all other versions since 1535. So there are as many editions of the King James Bible in roughly 30 years than there are all of the other editions of the English Bible combined since 1535. So that does not bespeak lack of interest in the King James Bible. It bespeaks the opposite, right? That there is a robust interest privately for people to get one. Yeah.
Doesn't that also speak to the technology too? Because you're also, if you go back in that number of years, your printing capability was completely different than it is now at this time.
Well, I'm sure that the technology had improved, but there's still...
It's still markedly different.
It's still markedly more robust during this period, during the King James period, than it was for the previous 100 years. Okay? And nearly all these 140 editions were non-folio. So that's not even counting the folio editions. Okay? Many of the smaller formats have no indications of ownership before 1640, but there are valuable exceptions which give us some insight into their various usage. In 1631, John Fisher, a yeoman of Burton on the Worlds in Lincolnshire, bought a quarto published in 1630, and it became the family Bible, listing names of family until the mid-19th century. An octavo of 1627 was owned by a scholar since it contained numerous annotations in Latin and Hebrew and with references to the patristics, that means the church fathers, while the owner of another octavo of 1639 may have been a layperson who quoted contemporary writers in English such as Daniel Featley, Jeremy Taylor, and John Boyce. Justinian Isham, right? The future royalist owned a duodecimo, 1626. The third part of the Bible, the Book of the Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, is inscribed in that, "This was the only book I carried in my pocket when I traveled beyond the seas, the 22nd year of my age, 1633, and many years after. Of the five books, he was particularly drawn to Psalms." So, you gotta balance out the ecclesiastical sales versus the private sales, right? Records suggest that what was created for public worship and ecclesiastical use became a staple in the home before its widespread use in Anglican churches. If we put the rapid sale of smaller formats of the King James Bible against the slow and uneven dissemination of folio or church Bibles, then it may well be that for many, the new translation became familiar in the home before it was heard in church, and that its broad acceptance by 1640 owed as much to personal use as it did to hearing it in public worship. Part of its appeal must be linked to its nonpartisan nature. The 16s represented the full spectrum of English Protestant churchmanship, and two of the four Puritan delegates at Hampton Court, Reynolds and Chatterton, were translators. So much so that John Waters, a parishioner of Yupton, Sussex, and a scoffer, right, of the could claim in 1623 that a company of Puritans had translated the Bible falsely and had got the king to put his hand thereunto. Although modern scholars are quick to observe that the iconic status of the King James Bible was a creation of later generations, some contemporaries, both conformists and Puritans, did admire the new translation. Were Joseph Hall and John Day reflecting or creating opinion when in 1620 they called the translation, quote, an exquisite edition? Clearly, though, the success of the King James Bible owed most to its monopoly among Bibles printed in England after 1619. First, the King's printers ceased printing the Geneva Bible in 1616, though second-hand copies could still be purchased or new editions imported from abroad. The Geneva Bible was no longer as freely available as once it had been. Then, 3 years later in 1619, the last edition of the New Testament portion of the bishops was printed. So, the market is changing, and people are buying these King James Bibles, and Fincham is suggesting that the adoption of the King James is probably due more so to its private sales than it was to its uneven adoption in parish pulpits. Fincham concluded his groundbreaking essay with the following paragraph. James I was better at initiating biblical projects than seeing them through. His sponsorship of a new Scottish translation in 1601 came to nothing, while his own translation of the Psalms was substantially the work of a collaborator and was published after his death. So too in 1604 he sponsored a new English translation of the Bible, but then allowed Archbishop Richard Bancroft to become the effective overseer as his attention moved on to more immediate issues. Bancroft's death in November 1610, less than a year before the new translation was published, is probably why it was neither formally authorized nor required to be purchased in the parishes. I already mentioned that earlier in the lesson. For his successor, the translator George Abbott, was not prepared to damage Anglo-Scottish relations and therefore left the individual bishops to determine if and when the new translation should reach the parish lecterns. It took a good 30 years for this to be accomplished across the country. In March 1642, Charles I visited the chapel of Little Gidding in Huntingdonshire, and was pleased to note that the Bible was a translation sponsored by his father. Even by that date, the use of the King James Bible in worship could not be taken for granted. Yet the slow dissemination of church Bibles sits uneasily with the growing acceptability of the King James Version by the 1640s. When attempts either to reintroduce the Geneva Bible or to undertake a fresh translation failed, the explanation appears to be the sustained demand in smaller formats for the King James Bible from the 1610s, coaxed by some enterprising product innovations by Barker, Norton, and Bill. This challenges the sharp distinction between the official King James Bible and the people's Geneva Bible. The widespread ownership and use of the King James Bible in household and private study, as well as its gradual acceptance into public worship, meant that it would survive when episcopacy and prayer book were abolished in the 1640s in England. Within 30 years of its publication, the English people's Bible was fast becoming the King James Version. So what we have to acknowledge is two sort of lanes. There's an ecclesiastical lane that's dealing with the folio edition for pulpit use, And then there's the smaller size formats that are for private use and sales. Those are far outselling what is happening with the large folio editions for church use. Okay? Now, does anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah.
With regards to the translators, all these groups, they kind of noted that with regards to the Puritans, that they had some kind of ownership in the King James because two of the translators were of puritanical background. But what, as far as the individuals go, were they swayed by that? And was that more of a key, or was it, I mean, obviously the king was pushing it, but, or was it the ecclesiastical that did accept it and kind of pushed it down? Because if that's the case, if they were by it in that compared to the episcopacy, where's the influencing point, I guess? What would be for the individuals?
Well, Fincham is saying, if I'm understanding Fincham's essay correctly, he's saying there are two things. Number one, there's an abundance of cheaper, smaller sized King James Bibles that are being published. Number two, by 1616, the King's printer is no longer publishing a Geneva Bible.
So those are translated, it really didn't have an influence on the individuals, per se.
Not really. I would say, maybe, but there's no documentation of, you know, they were necessarily out there promoting everyone buying it, with the exception of Miles Smith and a few other ones that had authority to force their parishes to buy them for private use. So there's an abundance of editions. The Geneva stops being printed in 1616. The King's printer is not going to print it. The last bishop's New Testament is published in 1519. And after that, the King's publishers are only printing the King James Bible. Amsterdam is going to be a primary publisher still of the Geneva Bible, but now they have to be imported into the country because there are no Geneva Bibles being published on British soil after that point.
I've heard those that are anti-KJV only, they will point to its clarity, and yet they'll state, well, it's just not as important upon a common individual then or today. And I would take difference to that because today there is a huge difference. You look at the NIV and you see who translated it. I think that has an impact on what you're getting.
So I would say the differences between a bishop's Bible, a Geneva Bible, and a King James Bible in the early 17th century are marginal. Okay? Because the bishop's Bible was revised, so the King James is a revision of the bishop's Bible, and the Geneva Bible was one of the ones that was heavily used to revise the bishop's Bible. So there might be some differences there, but they're very minor compared to now if you want to talk about a King James versus an NIV or a King James versus an ESV. It's not even a fair comparison to compare in our day a King James with an ESV and say, well, that's the same thing that happened back there between Geneva bishops and King James. That's not a fair comparison.
No, and that's kind of my point. Because
yeah.
What the non-King James folks will say is, Every generation or so, you're going to get people that are focused on refining. You talk about silver is refined so many times. They'll say, this is just a further refinement of the scripture. And I have to say that's not true. There's no way. Especially when you start plugging in the individuals and you see who's doing it. When you have a gay woman on the NIV one that was there supposedly. That was, you have a translator doing that and you've accepted that? To me, there's a distinct effect by who's doing it. Just like the one guy who couldn't get in, we talked about several weeks back.
Broughton?
I think it was Broughton. And how he was pitching a fit, little, you know, that guy. Well, he still had an influence because he still had some of the artwork in the front.
He had the genealogies.
Or the genealogies.
He's not influencing the biblical text, though.
Right, correct.
The inspired biblical text. So what's often said is that, well, what's going on with modern versions in our day is they're just updating the archaic Elizabethan English of the King James. That's not true. They're using an entirely different Greek text to make a new translation. They are not simply updating the King James. And that is a big misnomer even about the RSV, what came out in 1881. It was not, they went into a meeting with the intent of simply revising and updating the King James. And they came out the other side with an entirely different English Bible that substantively differed from the King James, because somewhere along the line, they started using a different Greek text, which cut verses out and made substantive changes to the Bible, and so the output at the end wasn't the same. It was not simply a King James Bible in updated language. You know, and ever since then, the majority, not all of them, the majority, there are a few modern translations that claim to be from the received text or the same underlying Greek text as the King James, but the vast majority of them are taken from what now is known as the modern critical text. So there's a lot of things that are said that you have to sort of sort through to really get to the bottom of what's accurately going on. Okay, so let's look at the conclusion. So this lesson concludes our discussion of the three subjects laid out in Lesson 222 related to the early history of the AV. We talked about early reception. We talked about early criticism. AJ just mentioned Broughton. And now we've talked about early sales. So over the course of the last five lessons, we have surveyed scholarly essay/journal articles that challenge the long-held view that the AV was not well received by the English-speaking world of the 17th century until the 1630s or later. Early 17th century sermons, in addition to early sales data, suggests that the AV was embraced and utilized in both public pulpits, Anglican and Puritan, as well as private homes during the first decade of its existence between 1611 and 1621. In the next lesson, we will survey the political fortunes of the English Bible during the English Civil War, and we will talk about, ultimately, the triumph of the King James. And we'll start looking at that next week. Okay? Anybody got any questions or comments? Yeah.
I think when you think about how much the Bible cost in 1620 or whatever, it's hard to get that, but just a quick check here on what wages were in 1800 in England. 1800, a laborer made 12 pounds per year.
Okay.
That, I mean, when you think of the shillings, what it was, 37 shillings for a folio, 20 shillings per pound. I mean, that's a tremendous price considering what people made back then.
Yeah.
And that might be some reason why it didn't take off very fast.
And remember, does the king's printer have a major financial outlay of somewhere between 1.5 million and 2 million in today's money to even get the rights to print it, and does he have to start recouping monies, or else is he going to be financially sunk? So that is, I think, another motivation for why the very second year that it's published in 1612, they immediately diversify on size and font so as to sell more copies.
Plus eliminating the other one.
That happens a few years later. That they're officially eliminated in the Geneva's officially eliminated in 1616, and then the last Bishop's New Testament is published in 1619. So it's a slow thing, but it definitely. But you are right, Mike. I mean, the amount of money. It's a little bit of a shameful thing. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know how many Bibles all of you have at your house. But I've got a ton of Bibles. And I'm just... And how many people are in the world that don't even have a Bible? You know? So I'm sitting at home and I've got a Bishop's Bible and I've got a Geneva Bible and I've got a Tyndale New Testament and a Matthew's Bible that I've bought in reproductions, not originals. Don't think I've made of money too much. Okay?
It works right now. There's one online.
Yeah, there's. I mean, I look at that stuff. There's auction houses right now. I looked at the first just this week. I took a screenshot of the title page of one of these King James Bibles with the Geneva footnotes in it. And there's an auction house in London that's selling one for like £1,300. I don't know what that relates to in American money, other than I don't have that much money to buy that. I mean, that'd be cool to have it, but I'm not going to buy it. I'll wait for somebody to digitize it and put it online. And then I'll swipe the PDF for free. Yeah, Bart.
In reference to size, the Bibles we typically bring to church today, are they Octavian size or quarto size?
So I think the sizing of Bibles has changed somewhat, but I think that Bible that you have there is smaller than an octavo.
Okay.
It's probably more of a quarto size, roughly.
Well, isn't that bigger than octavian?
No, octavo's bigger.
Quarto is roughly 9.5 by 12.
It was a big sheet cut in quarters.
Yeah. The folio's like 19.5 by...
But I thought the octavian was like 1/8.
Yeah. No.
No. What's the size of the octavo?
8.25 by 11.5.
So it's almost the size of a standard piece of paper.
Oh, okay. So that's the octavo.
So that one would be this size, taken it, turned this way, and then folded in half.
Okay, that's about what mine is.
That's about what you have.
Quarto?
Yeah.
I'm
just curious.
1651.
Huh?
He's about 1651.
Oh. Yeah, too much. Out of my price. Out of my price range.
You have to sleep in the office.
Yeah, I have to not eat for a year.
The last sentence there on page 6, it says, when Episcopate, and the curve was abolished in the 1640s, is that during the Civil War?
Yes. That's part of what Cromwell's...
But we'll hear more about that next
time. Yeah.